This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Picture 200 people dancing with headphones to the same music. The Melting Pot radio show will have a series of silent dance parties from 8 to 10 p.m. Tuesdays in Portland parks and public spaces. That's Tuesdays from 8 to 10 p.m. For more information and this week's location, go to kboo.fm/silent dance parties.
KBOO Community Radio continues the broadcast of the 2013 Illahi Lecture Series on Tuesday, March 19th, when we broadcast a talk by John Stauber.
Founder of the Center of Media Democracy, John Stauber is an independent writer, organizer, and activist. He has co-authored 6 books, including the bestsellers Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Trust Us, We're Experts, and New York Times bestseller Weapons of Mass Deception. In 1993, he founded the nonprofit Center for Media and Democracy in Madison.
John will be speaking at the First Congregational Church in Portland, and KBOO will broadcast the talk live at 7 p.m. Tuesday, March 19th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/illahi2013.
Starting Thursday and continuing every day of our spring membership drive, it's KBOO's Vintage Poster Contest. Each morning at 7 a.m., we will post a new image of a historic KBOO event poster on our website, kboo.fm. You'll have until 3 p.m. that same day to enter the contest for a chance to win the only other known copy of the poster. See the art and enter the contest at kboo.fm. Only one entry per person per day. Spread the word about KBOO's poster contest. Anyone can enter. Scanning and reproduction services for KBOO's poster contest provided by Technical Imaging Services located in Portland's Old Town.
Lie to me, baby. Tell me what I need to know. Lie to me, baby. The painful truth I already know. Take me by the hand, tell me I'm your man, and lie to me, baby.
Good morning.
Well, good morning. This is KBOO 90.7 FM dial in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe talk radio show. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. And the number is 231-8187 to talk to us, and it's the anniversary of the Great War.
Not the Great War.
The Great War.
That was like 100 years ago, wasn't it?
Well, it was a pretty good war. This is a great war.
This is a great war.
Yeah.
Yeah, about 10 years ago.
Well, exactly.
We invaded exactly 10 years ago. We invaded a country that didn't do anything to us.
Well, it had yellow cake.
No, it didn't.
Had yellow cake.
No.
Had yellow cake, and it might show up as a mushroom cloud.
No.
No mushroom cloud?
No.
But it was in danger of being bad.
Okay, maybe.
Remember a few years before that, it took the babies out of the incubators and threw the babies on the floor and stole the incubators. And then it turned out that wasn't so.
Right.
But it was almost so.
This aggression will not stand.
Right. That was George the Greater.
George the Smarter.
George the Smarter, yes.
10 years ago, we invaded a country that had nothing to do with the attacks on September 11th.
Did too.
No,
yes.
It didn't.
Oh, yeah.
We were led to believe that it did.
Yeah.
This is possibly one of the most monumental deceptions ever perpetrated upon the American public. I want to talk today about what it was like in the run-up to the war about 10 years ago. I don't recall another time in my life where I felt more conflicted.
Really?
More frightened.
Really?
More horrified at what my government was about to do.
See, you have the gift of youth. Perpetual.
Perpetual. Yes.
Perpetual youth.
Yes.
I mean, in the sense that you can be still surprised and shocked by the lying creepiness of American government.
Well, I had been I'd been wise to the lying creepiness of American government prior to that. I'm a bit of a student of history, and I was.
There you go.
I didn't grow up in a vacuum. Public school education was actually halfway decent when I was young. I learned about these things.
Okay.
But I still remember at the time, just a disconnect between what I was seeing unfold and what virtually everybody knew to be the truth, which was that, first of all, Iraq had nothing to do with the September 11th attacks, and second of all, the primary pretense for war, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, was absolutely false.
100%. No, it was true. It just, they're
false.
They're still hidden in a clever cave somewhere.
Right. Or as Rumsfeld said that day, so north, east, south, and west somewhat, he said. Remember that?
Somewhat?
Yeah. I've been going back the last few days and reading press accounts from that time and looking at video clips, and it's just brought that whole surreal convulsion back down upon me. That's what it was. It was convulsion. The country went collectively nuts after September 11th. Aided and abetted by a fear-mongering chief executive.
Well, you know, there was absolutely no reason to go to war. Oh, sorry. What?
No, there was absolutely no reason to go to war. And we did. We did, and we're still there 10 years later and nearly $3 trillion later. Nearly hundreds of thousands of dead Iraqis, thousands of dead Americans, and the eternal loss of the prestige and admiration that we enjoyed abroad.
See, that's the thing. In previous wars where there was no reason to go to war, for example, the Mexican War,
right?
We got a third of Mexico. So
right.
that's a good reason, yeah. See? It right. May not be righteous.
Yeah, Spanish War, we got the Philippines and Puerto Rico.
And Cuba.
And right. Yeah, for a while.
And Guam. We still have Guam. Yeah. And, and the coaling stations, that was good.
Yeah, that was good.
And access to all of Asia.
Yeah, all that was good.
That was good. See, so there were two false wars that got us something. You're just objecting to the fact that it didn't get us anything.
That's right. If we'd just grabbed Iraq, planted a flag, and said it's ours, yeah, everything would have been fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, if it had been, you know, traditional imperialism than just simply global capitalism.
My true disappointment is that when they brought in those huge shrink wrap piles of $50 and $100 bills, huge shrink wrap piles.
A big pallet.
Big pallets of them, that I didn't get one.
Yeah.
But somebody did.
You get one of those on your porch?
Somebody did. Boy, I would like a fax, ARP somebody to bring me a big shrink rack pile of $100 bills.
Well, you keep waiting for that.
I'm waiting.
Let me know how that goes.
Yeah.
All right, so I want to hear from you today, listeners, about your recollections of that period immediately before the war, what you were doing, what you were thinking.
And did you go for it?
Yeah, did you go for it?
Did any of you go for it? Do some of you still think it was okay?
And
Dick Cheney was on TV. He said it was great.
He did say it was. Yeah, he said he had no regrets.
Well, Dick Cheney doesn't have any regrets because they removed his heart and replaced it with a new one.
Right, right. He's one of the undead. Remember on the show, whenever we talked about Cheney, we used to play the march from Star Wars?
Right.
We should have brought that up today.
He was one of the undead. He is one of the undead, but he's got a new heart.
He's got a new heart.
Yes.
If only that were true in the larger metaphorical sense, but yes, it's only true in the very literal, very
He used to be a handsome
sense.
Man, too.
He used to be a handsome man.
You know how evil in the picture of Dorian Gray sense shows up on a portrait? Well, in Cheney's case, there's no portrait. There's just Cheney.
There's just Cheney. There are no men like Cheney. There's simply Cheney. You know, it could be very credibly argued that the real story of those years was Cheney's will to power.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
He was the real president because George the Lesser was too stupid to be anything but the face of the government.
So I want to talk to you about that period before the war, which, as I mentioned, is one of the most surreal and conflicted that I can recall in my lifetime. I want to talk about the way the war itself unfolded and the subsequent occupation, and I want to talk about the aftermath. 10 years gone.
Yeah, but the yellow cake, man. The yellow cake.
You know, and we'll get to all that.
The mushroom cloud.
There's so much there. Those were frenetic times. That was weird. That was just really weird.
I've always had the hots for Condoleezza Rice.
Yeah, I know that you have.
I mean, anytime anybody can bring us to war with simple lies.
I mean, they really were simple lies too.
Yeah.
Colin Powell.
poor Colin Powell.
Squandered a lifetime of
He could have
respect.
Been president. He could have been the first black president.
Yeah, that's just sad.
Well.
The whole thing was sad. The way intelligence was selectively cherry-picked and stovepiped.
Is stovepiping?
Stovepiping was a term that actually came into vogue at the time, by which essentially it described the way intelligence was selectively gathered and stuffed up the stovepipe straight to the top, to Rumsfeld, where he could then report it to the president and the vice
there's
president.
There's a filthy metaphor here.
Well, there's certainly a filthy... There's any number of filthy metaphors for this whole thing. And it goes back even... overturning Saddam Hussein was something that really had nothing to do with the September 11th attacks. It was on Cheney's mind from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Cheney, as you recall, was Bush the smarter Secretary of Defense.
Right.
We have these reports from very early on in the Bush administration of oil company executives meeting with Cheney in the White House, going over maps of Iraq. When those records of those meetings were attempted to be obtained by groups like Judicial Watch and others via lawsuits. They were stonewalled at every turn by the administration. We still don't know the details of what happened in those meetings early in the Bush administration. Mm. But we knew that invading Iraq was on the table from the very beginning, long before the attacks of September 11, 2001.
Just for the oil?
Primarily for the oil.
And if I understand the situation today, after 10 years, many losses of lives in Iraq, and of course, American soldiers squandered away, and a lot of crippled people, and a lot of all kind of bad thing, and a huge amount of money wasted, and so on. After all this, the accomplishment, the real accomplishment of the war, is to bring Iraq into the sphere of influence of Iran.
That's been the real consequence. It certainly wasn't the objective.
But that allows us to have a war with Iran, you see.
Oh, you see, it's just setting one domino up to knock the next.
Yeah,
by
come on,
a cynic,
we have to knock off those Iranians.
But another characteristic of that surreal period before the war was the way that conventional wisdom sort of solidified around the idea that going to war in Iraq was the right thing to do, and everybody else, by definition, was a traitor and a dirty hippie. It was astounding the way this happened. I mean, I remember having arguments with otherwise very intelligent people who bought this whole thing hook, line, and sinker.
Well, sure. Going to war with a casus belli such as Yellowcake, I mean, that all makes perfect sense. I want to tell you really briefly a little story. Back before, in the Iraq War I, the first war, with George the Smarter, or George the Greater, and with the lying stories about the babies being thrown out of the incubators, et cetera, all this propaganda, my boss, and I was on commercial radio in those days, my boss said to me, okay, well, now you've opposed the war, but now that we're in it, you're going to flip and support the war, right? And I said, no, I don't think so. And he was so disappointed. I mean, I had on the air, to be fair, even-handed, I had a guy from Mossad.
Mm-hmm.
I had a professor from Portland State who was pro-Israel. I tried to be fair. But Lord knows it was nonsense. That was the war where we wiped out most of Saddam Hussein's army. Along the road, what was it called?
The Highway of Death.
The Highway of Death, which it was.
Right. Where we fired upon and decimated a retreating army. It was horrible.
Yeah, retreating.
I don't want to talk about that first Iraq war. I want to talk about the second
war. Okay, the second war. Right. Better.
Yes, but before we continue with this conversation, we have on the line with us Mr. Dan Handelman, who has been part of organizing a couple of events today commemorating, such as it is, the 10th anniversary of the war. Dan, welcome. Yeah.
Hello, thank you.
So tell us what you got going on today.
Troublemaker, Dan. You're a troublemaker.
I'm part of the Peace and Justice Works Iraq Affinity Group, which formed about a year after Gulf War Part 1. I know we're not supposed to talk about that.
Yeah, it's okay.
But, we also have today planned these two events, Visibility Action Downtown from 3:30 to 5:30.
Wait a minute, stop right here. What's a Visibility Action?
Well, it's something in between a vigil and a demonstration. So it's a event where we have something very visible that people downtown will be able to see, and we'll be handing out literature and encouraging them to come to the second event.
Well, wait a minute. Do we get to see the fully armored patrols of police?
No, I don't think.
That's no fun without those guys.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that the point is for us to get our message out.
Serious here. Okay,
yeah, I am sorry about that. And thing that's going to be visible is two 10-foot tall banners that say "U.S. out of Iraq" and a third one that says 10 years later to remind everybody why we're there. Because many people, and it's sort of interesting to me that this hasn't been the context of this discussion yet. Many people don't think there's anything going on in Iraq anymore, and that it's so yesterday, and let's stop talking about it because the U.S. isn't, quote unquote, isn't there anymore. But I'm glad that the two of you have contextualized it for the audience. That yes, there's the world's largest embassy is there. There's, you know, at least 10,000 people there, including contractors and military and diplomats. And
well, we have the functional equivalent of prison for life for people who did nothing. That's still going on.
Oh, well, yeah, Guantanamo, that Guantanamo, started, of course, before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mercenaries, we got the mercenaries, the huge mercenary army. In fact, the other day there was a car bombing.
Yeah.
Yeah, just the other day. So.
Yep. So, we're going to be down at the corner of Southwest Broadway and Morrison, right by Pioneer Courthouse Square, mm-hmm. with this 12-foot tall tower, and we're going to be handing out leaflets. And we have a fact sheet that kind of lays out a lot of the history between 2003 and today about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then at 7 o'clock tonight, down at the First Unitarian Church, Kathy Breen, who's with the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who actually was in Iraq in 2002 and to the lead up and through shock and awe, actually went back there in October and November and spent 6 weeks in Iraq and talked to Iraqis. So she's going to show pictures and tell stories about what Iraqis are saying today about the invasion and occupation.
That should be really interesting, seriously. I mean, we tend to, in the U.S., to pretend or act as a people as if we're the only folks on Earth.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, I know, too, we talk on KBU, like Portland's the only city in Oregon, and just for folks who are down in the southern areas, in Eugene, Kathy will be speaking tomorrow, Wednesday night at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Church down there in Eugene, sponsored by the Community Alliance of Lane County. So if you miss her up here in Portland tonight at 7 o'clock, you can see her in Eugene tomorrow.
Wow. I'm really glad, Dan, that you guys, seriously, that you guys are doing this, because the American people, unfortunately, plagued as they are with so-called media information centers, totally don't remember or understand or underappreciate this. We have, as a heritage of this disastrous 10 years going on war, a huge number of American men and women who have been hurt, who have been both psychologically and physically hurt. And we, of course, have a Veterans Administration and a government, even the Obama government, who aren't doing right by those people. So there's a lot to talk about here.
Right. Well, not to mention the Iraqis themselves.
Oh, the Iraqis themselves. Those are foreigners.
the New York Times last week put the numbers at 4,486 American dead, 32,226 American wounded, and over 100,000 Iraqi dead.
So, which I think is an underestimate.
I completely agree with you. I think it's closer to 1 million Iraqis who've died since the invasion, but that's the official newspaper of the United States, blah, blah. So for them to admit that at least 100,000 Iraqis died because the invasion we used to have this argument about how many Iraqis were killed by the sanctions
mm-hmm.
Between 1990 and 2003, and people would argue that it couldn't be more than 1 million, and we'd say, well, how many children dying is okay for you?
Right, exactly. Well, I like shock and awe myself. Fireworks have always pleased me.
Yeah, that was very, very depressing watching the
it was very
city
depressing.
Of Baghdad erupt in flames for the second
really?
Time in 12 years. Yeah.
Really? Okay, well, listen, man, I think I'll... What time, again, is the one downtown?
So downtown one is from 3:30 to 5:30 at Southwest Broadway and Morrison. They're actually both downtown. Southwest Broadway and Morrison. And then the 7 o'clock is at the First Unitarian Church.
Okay, I'm definitely going to go to the 3:30 thing.
Great.
Because I'm hoping they'll bring out the armored patrols because they're so cool.
Okay, thanks.
I'm sorry, I'm very cynical. All right, thanks a lot, Dan.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much, Dan.
Yeah. I think that demo is important.
I think so,
actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, why don't we take some phone calls?
Yeah, we want to take some phone calls.
Andy, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm glad you talked about the Bush administration having this, I guess I can't say this anatomical term for their desire to go after Iraq even before the 9/11 disaster.
Right.
Because I remember reading on the front page of the Oregonian on September 12th, the day after the the terrorist attacks. A quote from Paul Wolfowitz, who was some high muckety-muck, I think, in the Defense Department or the State Department at the time.
Deputy Secretary of Defense.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
He was quoted in the newspaper as saying that certain states would have to cease to exist. This is what he said the day of 9/11.
Oh, really?
And was put it in the paper the next day. And I knew from that point on that we were going to war in Iraq. It seemed like, you know, that had been a predetermined decision. And it gives credence. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't believe in this stuff about 9/11 being an inside job.
Yeah.
But the mindset of the Bush administration and their public statements lead credence to the idea that they were kind of happy it happened because it gave them excuses to run roughshod over democracy and over international law. So that's all I got to say. I appreciate the program. I think it's a very important topic, and I'm glad you guys are doing it.
Well,
so thanks
a lot. Well, yeah, and I seriously, I like to kid around about this because I'm extremely bitter and cynical about American foreign policy and have been for many, 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 many years.
No way.
Yeah. But this was this war, and I guess Afghanistan, go beyond the cynicism that I feel as a historian when I talk about the Mexican War, which I mentioned earlier. The Mexican War, at least in a pragmatic and vicious way, yielded us a whole bunch of wealth and land and made, therefore, some sense. The Iraq War, aside from making military contractors extremely wealthy, did nothing for the United States. Our security is less, not greater. Our image in the world is lesser, not greater. Our squandering of everything is huge. It was an unmitigated, unprecedented idiocy, a disaster beyond belief.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, with that fair-minded evaluation of it, we'd like to hear from the rest of you. 231-8187.
Paul, good morning.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Pretty good.
All right. Well, first, your assessment of past wars, the Spanish-American War and others where we've taken property and land from other people, I don't think that's all that much different from the Iraq War.
Yeah, but we didn't get Iraq.
As I look at it from a different angle, that the powers that be get something from going to war.
Oh, sure.
Now, in this case, we never get anything. They
right.
achieved the ends that they were looking for. 100 years ago, they were looking for land. Now, they're looking for other things, not just land. If you look at it like even your analogy of going into Iraq to push them towards Iran so that we'd have a pretext to go to war with Iran.
Oh, no, I never said that. I don't think it's that vast a conspiracy, but go ahead.
Well, just along those lines, look at it like a chess game.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not playing checkers here. One move now may not make sense, but, you know, three or four moves.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then it makes sense, and that's what these guys do. They've been around forever. I mean, look at, I look at recent history as well, and, you know, looking at Cheney and Rumsfeld and listening to these guys talk about not just the first Iraq War, but right before that, the invasion of Panama and all the things that these guys have been involved in. These guys are always in the background, always in the shadows, doing their thing, shaping policy towards a particular end that always benefits a certain few and never the whole country, even if we could look at it and say, well, you know, we gained all these islands and, oh, that's a real, real strategic purpose. But to the actual people like us, doesn't mean anything. It means we have dead family members, blood on our hands of innocent people, and the game has not changed. Only the means and the location has changed.
Yeah, and I might add that Cheney will not die. They will replace various parts of him throughout history. 1,000 years from now, there will be a Dick Cheney.
There will be a thousand
incarnations of him.
Yeah.
There's always another Cheney to fill the gap.
Well, no, in this case it'll be him, the zombie Cheney, you know, the robot Cheney.
Hey, listen, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah,
appreciate it.
I've become bitter, you know.
I know you've become bitter.
I just can't believe the stupidity of the United States. But apart from the moral and ethical dimension, which makes us the bad guys historically right now.
Right.
Apart from that, apart from that, there's the stupidity of it and the short-sightedness of it, and then the question of who benefits. Well, who benefits? The mercenary class, which has grown enormously. You know,
yes.
The oil industry, which can never lose in these situations, because they get the oil either way.
They get the oil either way.
Yeah,
and they would have gotten it either way.
Yeah.
Anyway,
and the price might be different. And the ruling class, the military industrial congressional class, all of these people have essentially taken over the consciousness of the United States as it presents itself to the world and as it works internally, and the American people become either totally disengaged and uninvolved, or they're fooled.
Yeah. The question of who benefits is an important one to ask in this context.
Well, yeah.
Because what happened after the invasion and the occupation began? Then the very ambitious, very expensive reconstruction program began in earnest.
I'm still waiting for that shrink wrap pile of money.
Well, the shrink wrap pile of money, yes. That was only one. Graft and corruption on a massive scale.
Yeah.
Plunder. Iraq ceased to become a humanitarian reconstruction project and became a capitalist petri dish. I mean, this was the Ayn Randian blank slate that capitalists have been dreaming of for centuries.
And look what we got.
We went in and people cleaned up. Remember no-bid contracts?
Yes.
Remember building fast food franchises?
Yes.
Remember the building of modern chicken processing plants in a culture that had been growing and trading chickens on a local level for literally thousands of years?
Yes.
All this stuff happened. Billions of dollars spent. Billions of dollars plundered by American and other capitalist interests going into this country, not rebuilding it, essentially taking this public money that was there lying on the table or shrink-wrapped in massive pallets.
Yeah, I like shrink-wrapped massive pallets.
It was an orgy of greed and opportunism, the likes of which I have never beheld before.
Well, yeah. I mean, all of the wars we've had, whether justifiable or not, have involved the enormous increase of wealth and power to the military-industrial community. But this one, because it was totally unnecessary and because it was so excessive and so gross, exceeds any reasonable understanding of why, what, how, blah.
Well,
that's my big thing.
This was materially different. I mean, consider the Marshall Plan after the Second World War. That was actually a plan of reconstruction.
Yeah.
Yes, a lot of people made money participating in the Marshall Plan, but there was infrastructure left at the end. There are huge swaths of Iraq that today still want for clean water and reliable electricity and good transportation infrastructure.
And health care.
And health care, yes.
And food, even.
Right. Well, they can just go down to the one of many KFCs or McDonald's or Burger King that sprung up in the wake of the American occupation. It was a capitalist orgy. And that's exactly what the perpetrators of the war wanted.
Well, I think you're right. Let's talk to our callers, 231-8187. Frank, you're there.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that really astounded me about the Iraqi war, the lead up and then, towards the end of it, was that the whole thing, if you watch the news reports and the press releases and everything else, was scripted exactly like a Hollywood movie. They did the World War II, we're going to defeat fascism. They embedded the reporters to make this look like World War II, you know, mm-hmm. the liberators.
Mm-hmm.
Then they go ahead and they have these scenes of Saddam statues being toppled like the Berlin Wall. And the icing on
which was an arranged event, by the way.
Yeah.
But the icing on the cake was George Bush landing on the aircraft.
Oh, yes. I'm so glad you brought this up.
That was wonderful.
Yeah, he's like Bill Pullman in Independence Day.
Well, you know, that event was really wonderful in so many ways. The aircraft carrier was right offshore in San Diego. They turned the carrier around so that he could land seemingly in the middle of the carrier in the middle of the ocean.
He wasn't flying the plane,
though. No, of course he wasn't flying the plane. He can't even drive a car. This is a dummy.
Yeah.
This is a really stupid man. Sorry. President of the United States. Got to give him respect.
Yeah. But I mean, they duplicated the scene out of Independence Day, when Bill Pullman, after they defeat the aliens, the president comes in as a jet pilot. And the people, what amazes me, the American people bought that, and they did go, this is absurd.
Oh, yeah, that wasn't that a surreal display? The mission accomplished banner behind him on the aircraft? That that picture, you can see that on our show page KBOO.fm/Abe and Joe.
And that, of course, was right before the Iraqis began to get it together to oppose us. And
what disturbed me most was, you know, is the American public so driven by the media and the fantasy that the media creates that even when the government creates it and scripts it, they buy it. There's no distinction as to reality.
Yeah, that was really an astounding feature of the run-up to war. Just how perception and reality just became turned on their heads. Up was down, black was white, and every day we were spoon-fed more of this.
These colors don't run.
Yeah, but it was played to the public like a Hollywood movie.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
No,
anyways, good to hear the conversation.
Hey, thank you for the call. This is how Paul Krugman put it in his column yesterday, talking about this this strange illusion of consensus.
Oh, what is he, some lousy Nobel Prize winning economist?
Here's what he says. Support for the war became part of the definition of what it meant to hold a mainstream opinion. Anyone who dissented, no matter how qualified, was ipso facto labeled as unworthy of consideration. This was true in political circles. It was equally true of much of the press, which effectively took sides and joined the war party.
Well, that's what the press always does in America, unfortunately.
There was Cronkite going to Vietnam and saying,
that was when it fell apart.
That was when it fell apart, certainly. And there was a marked, the abdication of responsibility by the press is one of the things that lingers the most in my mind from those days. And it was horrible. So bad, in fact, that years after the fact, the New York Times published an apology for its pre-war coverage. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Astounding. And this is what happened. We're going to play a little audio clip now for you. This is from about 2004. This is from the venerable Helen Thomas of the Washington Post, one of the first times she'd been called on in a White House press conference during the Bush administration. And she asked one of the rare straight-up questions of the president about the war. Here it is.
I ask you, Mr. President, your decision to invade Iraq has caused the deaths of thousands of Americans and Iraqis, wounds of Americans and Iraqis for a lifetime. Every reason given, publicly at least, has turned out not to be true. My question is, why did you really want to go to war? Mm-hmm. From the moment you stepped into the White House, from your cabinet, former cabinet officers, intelligent people, and so forth. Mm-hmm. What was your real reason? You have said it wasn't oil, quest for oil. It hasn't been Israel or anything else. What was it?
I think your premise, and all due respect to your question and to you as a lifelong journalist, is that, you know, I didn't want war. To assume I wanted war is just flat wrong, Helen, in all due respect. No, hold on for a second, please. Excuse me. No president wants war. Everything you may have heard is that, but it's just simply not true. My attitude about the defense of this country changed on September the 11th. When we got attacked, I vowed then and there to use every asset at my disposal to protect the American people. Our foreign policy changed on that day, Helen. You know, we used to think we were secure because of oceans and previous diplomacy, but we realized on September 11, 2001, that killers could destroy innocent life. And I'm never going to forget it. And I'm never going to forget the vow I made to the American people that we will do everything in our power to protect our people. Part of that meant to make sure that we didn't allow people to provide safe haven to an enemy, and that's why I went into Iraq. Hold on for a second. Excuse me for a second, please. Excuse me for a second. They did. The Taliban provided safe haven for Al-Qaeda. That's where Al-Qaeda trained and... Helen, excuse me. That's where Afghanistan provided safe haven for Al-Qaeda. That's where they trained. That's where they plotted. That's where they planned the attacks that killed thousands of innocent Americans. I also saw a threat in Iraq. I was hoping to solve this problem diplomatically. That's why I went to the Security Council. That's why it was important to pass 1441, which was unanimously passed. And the world said, disarm, disclose, or face serious consequences. And therefore, we worked with the world. We worked to make sure that Saddam Hussein heard the message of the world. And when he chose to deny inspectors, when he chose not to disclose, then I had the difficult decision to make to remove him, and we did, and the world is safer for it.
That was President Bush answering Helen Thomas at the White House.
Well, and I would point out that he's lying in so many ways.
Oh, yeah.
The inspectors were welcome. They went all over Iraq constantly, couldn't find any weapons of mass destruction.
We had one of the leaders of the inspection teams, a former Marine, Scott Ritter, publicly went on a press crusade around this time saying, look, there's nothing there. There are no weapons of mass destruction.
And then there were the supposed trucks, the secret trailers that were
moving all the time. We can't find them because they're moving all the time.
Right, with their nuclear weapons.
Right, right. We can't see them with our satellites because, I don't know, they're moving all the time.
And then when we took over the country, we couldn't find them. They hid the weapons so well. They're still there. They're still hidden somewhere.
But that was that 2 or 3 minutes of President Bush's response to that question so neatly encapsulates that whole up is down sort of flavor of those times. Dissembling, back and forth, tying himself into knots, offering a circular argument. He wouldn't allow the inspectors who were there because we were accusing him of having these things which he never had, and he kicked them out and he never had it. It was just up is down, left is right. And we bought it. The American people bought it.
Well, I'm not, this is an interesting question. I don't know whether there was any surveys of the American people and how often those were done or taken and published during this period of time. It's certainly true that there is a significant population of Americans who believe that whatever the government does is patriotic and right. But I suspect more and more people, even then, were dubious about this whole thing. I wanted to mention one thing that I think is very important historically. The United States, under Richard Nixon, when he was president, did away with the draft.
Yes.
Now, the draft was a major element in the fight against the war in Vietnam. Doing away with the draft was a strategically brilliant move because it created a situation where most American young men, and nowadays women, didn't have to face the danger of direct conflict. They could volunteer for it. And given economic circumstances for most poorer people, the armed services was a reasonable career, or at least interim choice, for what to do for a living after you get out of high school. Now, that meant that you had a volunteer army. With a volunteer army, you don't have the kind of opposition you get if your son or daughter is facing having a draft when they're in the middle or a successful working class.
Yeah, that's very true. In fact, Charlie Rangel, in the middle of the war, brought up a bill in Congress to reintroduce the draft.
Right.
Thinking that this was, if all of a sudden, if wealthy sons and daughters were tapped on the shoulder to go fight these imperialist wars, maybe we wouldn't have them quite so often. That's a very good point. An all-volunteer army takes away that major source of resistance for the war. I think that reason, more than any other, is why we didn't see people in the streets protesting this war in the kinds of numbers we did during Vietnam.
Well, and even during the Vietnam War, it takes a lot to get people out. It takes a direct fear, a direct understanding that you personally are at risk, as well as a moral assessment of the wrongness of whatever the hell it is that is going on.
Certainly. And an all-volunteer army begs another question, too. What do you do if you don't have enough volunteer soldiers to do what you need to do? Well, you hire mercenaries. And that had its own backlash in Iraq.
Well, yeah, I think at one point we had as many mercenaries as soldiers in Iraq.
We did, and they were making, and this was another of the war's great ironies, for essentially doing the same job, these mercenaries were making many, many times more than the soldiers wearing the uniform of the United States serving right alongside of them.
Right.
That's just a horrible inversion of whatever you know, a serving in uniform is supposed to be in a larger sense. Now, you may or may not buy into those sorts of ideals, but there are many people who do. And I have to imagine that some guy who volunteered out of high school out of a sense of duty or a sense of obligation had to felt a little bit bitter serving next to a guy who was making six figures as a mercenary.
Really? And, you know, all of this war, all of this activity in the Middle East serves to prepare us for the next great war in that region.
Against Iran.
Against Iran, which I think will be a similar sort of disaster. It is really a foreign policy without a soul.
Yeah.
Or without any rational process.
And just how about hearing President Bush talk?
I love him. He was the best. He was the most articulate president we've ever had.
Oh, boy. All right, let's go back to the phones. Mike, good morning.
Good morning. Hey, thank you.
Sure.
For your show. We've got our own metaphors also. I mean, there's a metaphor, you know, why do we kill people who kill people to show them that killing people is wrong?
And
I think the logic of that, you know, and when the power of love overcomes the love of power, you know, then we'll actually achieve peace. And I think these metaphors are on our side that say, hey, there's a... I remember going to the WTO walk up in Seattle, and there was Anonymous who kind of gave out a poem, and he kind of compared the whole WTO thing to the tip of a wave that has forgotten its source. And so I really think that's kind of true. I mean, Wolfowitz and all of these neocons that were all kind of coming into power, they kind of reflect a part of the U.S. psyche that is very afraid of losing what it has for what you know it thinks will happen to it, and so John Trudell was a really inspirational guy who kind of stood up to power in a very direct way, and he kind of said to don't look at, he says, distinguish between power and authority.
Cause right.
He says ruling factors like soldiers and guns and all of these things are authority. You know, if someone comes to you with a .45 and he sticks it in your mouth and he says, do this or else, then you really have no choice but to do what he says. You know, I mean, it's a real deal. And so you do, retain your center, retain your core of who you are and what you believe in, because nobody can ever, you know, take that away.
Well, and I think you're making a really important point. The Quakers for years and many others have used the expression speaking truth to power.
Yes.
And that is a crucial moral requirement in this age. But, of course, in order for that to be the case, you have to understand what is the truth. And the American media totally failed the American people during this period of time. The lies that were told by the administration were more or less accepted, even though they were incredible and not supportable by any kind of evidence.
Again, they're supported. There, you know, you know, like when I go down to, like, I went to New Orleans Jazz Fest, and so you go down there and you see U.S. military slogans all plastered over all of these industrial warehouses and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And that psyche is there, that psyche that says, you know, power is what counts, money is what counts, you know, and that's the real deal. And there's a whole bunch of us that still retain on to that. So I just saw What the Bleep Do I Know the other night again.
Right.
You know, and
it's a great film.
It really got to me, intentional manifestation. You know, we have to, as a core part of the future, we have to center ourselves. We have to intentionally manifest a peaceful world. We have to be peace. We have to, all of these things. And it's not a passive stance. It's a very, very aggressive stance.
No, I really appreciate the last thing you said, because it's very important. Struggling for peace is a very importantly aggressive activity, challenging the powerful. A set of problems that were perceived very clearly by a very famous warrior and president of the United States, Dwight David Eisenhower, in his last address to the American people, where he warned against the military-industrial complex. And I would add the words, I would add one word, military-industrial congressional complex.
Which is turning into a prison complex.
That's right.
Really.
Hey, listen, man, thank you so much.
Thank you very
much. For your
much.
Call and your insights.
Okay, cheers.
All right, little Biz here.
Oh, wait, before you do that, I want to remind people about the demo tomorrow.
Okay.
It's at 3:30 to 5:30 at at Morrison and Broadway.
Is it tomorrow or today?
Today.
Today.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. Today, right now, today.
That's right. Later today.
Today. I'm going to go.
All right, coming up this morning on KBOO on a 9 Alternative Radio, independent journalist Christopher DeBilaug speaks on Iran, coup. Jeez. Iran, coup. Sanctions and threat of war. At 10 here, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints marks the 10th anniversary of the war in Iraq with a new radio documentary by Nora Barrows Friedman. At 11, on stage and studio host D. May Roberts looks at Milagro Theater's Guapa, an inspiring tale of a young woman's dream to be an international soccer star. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Galvan interviews Portland artist James Minden about his current exhibition of handmade holograms. Wow. Titled Real/Unreal. All this and more coming up today on KBOO. I want to go back to the phones, but before we do that, I want to touch on one more thing.
Well, I want to remind people we're talking about today's the 10th anniversary of the ongoing, not quite over yet, war in Iraq.
That's right. In addition to the tragedy visited upon Iraq and its people by this war, casualties also occurred here in the United States. I'm talking most notably about the Fourth and First Amendments to the Constitution. Those were chilling times. Those were times when it felt like it was dangerous to speak out. Attorney General Ashcroft, as you recall, organized a program that encouraged Americans to rat out each other.
Yes.
To keep watch on one another. You had the press secretary to the president of the United States telling people they should watch what they say. There is definitely a sort of with us or against us mentality going on. And it made being a dissenter feel like a dangerous thing to do. It was scary.
You know, the other time which is parallel to this is during the lead up to World War One.
Yeah, there was a lot of the same sort
of
thing.
A lot of the same sort of psychology, only, of course, this was a time when media was not as intrusive or significant, and it was all print media. But yeah. But that's women used to give men in England and then also in the United States yellow feathers if they weren't volunteering or going or getting involved in the war.
Now there's some symbolism.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Here's what President Bush said in a speech 2006 to the veterans of foreign wars. This is on the subject of dissent.
Mm-hmm.
The American people know the difference between responsible and irresponsible debate when they see it. They know the difference between honest critics who question the way the war is being prosecuted and partisan critics who claim that we acted in Iraq because of oil or because of Israel or because we misled the American people. And they know the difference between a loyal opposition that points out what is wrong and defeatists who refuse to see that anything is right. See, we're right, and you are an irresponsible critic if you suggest it was
by definition.
You are a partisan if you suggest that anything went wrong in the lead up to war.
So, one of the great lines from Bertolt Brecht, and I suppose earlier writers, is that the first casualty of war is the truth.
Is the truth,
you know.
And finally, before we go back to the phones to round out the show, it costs a buttload of money to invade and occupy Iraq. A buttload of money, all of which was borrowed. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan mark the first time in the history of the United States that we fought two foreign wars of choice entirely with borrowed money.
Well, and we're paying for that now. I mean, the Great Recession is in part due to that expenditure.
Indeed. We were not asked to sacrifice
the
anything
sequester
for this new existential threat to our very existence.
In fact, what President Bush said after 9/11 is basically, well, you know, spend some money, have a good time,
yeah,
don't worry.
Keep shopping, he said,
yes,
to us. A new study by the Costs of War Project estimate that 10 years after the Iraq invasion, the war has cost us $1.7 trillion. And on top of that, there's an additional $490 billion in benefits owed to war veterans. And these total expenses are expected to grow over the next four decades to more than $6 trillion.
And what's really interesting, say what you will about people who volunteered and went to that war, they are being messed over incredibly. The government has not fulfilled its promises to veterans. The wait period for getting benefits and getting acknowledged as a veteran is up to a year now.
Yeah. It's obscene. It's insulting. At the very least, the people who are forced to go to this place and to commit often what were dehumanizing acts, both to themselves and the victims of these acts, the very least that we owe them is competent care.
Yeah,
and timely care when they return. The fact that we have not extended that to them, I think, tells you all you need to know about what the real priorities of this war actually were.
Really, really. This is an enormous, I don't like a language like sin, but if there is such a thing as sin,
yeah,
this war was a great sin.
Yeah, we will be digging out from the moral rubble of this decision literally for decades.
And one of the things that I think all of us have a responsibility to do is to acknowledge that error and that horror and make sure that it does not happen again. I brought up the possibility of war with Iran very consciously because I see that there is in the works a great plan to involve us in even more war in the Middle East, this time against a modern industrial state, which is Iran.
I can hardly wait.
Boy, oh boy.
Let's go back to the phones. Thank you all for waiting patiently. Michael, good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
What's on your mind?
Well, as someone who believed before the war that Saddam Hussein had possibly even nukes, yeah. I want to bring up an interesting historical fact.
Before you do, let me ask you where you stand on that question now.
About whether he had nukes?
Do you still believe that he possessed the weapons that were used as justification for the invasion?
Well, obviously not, because okay. We went into the country and looked and didn't find them.
Right. Okay, go ahead.
But that's hindsight. Here's a fact from right after the first...
Wait. Yes, hindsight. But there was also foresight. There were so many of us saying before the war that there weren't weapons of mass destruction. The international community was saying there weren't weapons of mass destruction. The UN inspectors and everybody else who had been in there were saying there weren't weapons of mass destruction. So don't, you know, yes, in hindsight it's clear, but let's not forget that it was also clear ahead of the fact.
Okay, let me ask you something now. Let me ask you something. Do you know what a calutron is?
No.
Of course not. Nobody does. Nobody remembers this. A calutron is a primitive cyclotron that can be used to separate isotopes like what you do when you want to make nuclear weapons.
Okay.
The first Gulf War happens, and then after that, IAEA inspectors get access to Iraq for the first time.
Yes.
And they find two enormous installations of calutrons.
Yes.
Calutrons were the first way the U.S. tried to separate isotopes during World War II to make nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
They find these two enormous installations of calutrons in Iraq that nobody knew were there until the IAEA went in and found them. By the time the Gulf War was about to happen, Saddam had kicked out all of the inspectors. Now, given that he got away with this before the first Gulf War happened, why wouldn't you think that he was doing something like that again? In foresight, not in hindsight. But this whole thing about the calutrons has disappeared down a memory hole. You didn't even know what they were.
Well, wait a minute. Is it your position, Michael, that the war was a rational decision and that only in hindsight we learned that it was a mistake?
Yep.
Hmm. Oh, I find that untenable.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah. I could make that case to you. There was a teach-in at PCC in 02 or 03. Probably 02, that I was one of the participants in.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a good job making my case then. I did a really good job making my case. You can say, oh, well, I had my foresight, and then look how it came out afterwards and see I was right. But going up in there, there was a lot of uncertainty, and you didn't know.
There was an uncertainty. We had teams of UN inspectors on the ground saying that there are no weapons of mass destruction.
There were no UN inspectors in there before the war.
Yes, there were.
There weren't UN inspectors running around.
Yes, there were. That was a huge controversy leading up to the invasion. Inspection teams were saying, oh, we're not finding anything. We had Scott Ritter, former member of the inspection teams, saying, no, there's nothing there.
Right.
It's all gone.
Right,
it was all cleared out after the first Gulf War.
And Baraday.
What happened with David Kay?
There were no weapons of mass destruction, Michael, and you're trying to make an ad hoc argument based on hindsight, saying that it was a rational decision to go into Iraq, and it clearly wasn't. If you believe it was, you're quite simply wrong.
Michael, I'm surprised at you, because you're a bright man. I don't understand how you can ignore the incredible lies that led up to the war, including the famous yellow cake nonsense.
You mean the thing about Valerie Plame?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I watched that whole thing with amazement as they went, you know, as the left went after everybody in the Bush administration over, oh, you outed an agent, and it turned out it was Richard Armitage who outed them. And but meanwhile, they went after Scooter Libby and everybody, and the fact that it was actually Richard Armitage, it didn't even matter. It didn't even matter. You know, you have your view of what it was like going up to the Iraq War. I have mine, and I was very rational about it.
Indeed.
Just like you were.
The difference, Michael, is that one view is supported by the facts and the other is not.
Well, you know, the Calutrons were also a fact.
Yes, they were.
And if Saddam Hussein had succeeded in concealing two huge industrial isotope separation plants at one point in history, how were we to know that he wasn't successful in doing that?
You're right. I concede the point, Michael. It was a totally rational decision to invade, and I eagerly await the invasions of South Africa, of Israel, of France, of Britain, of China, of every other nuclear state, because we know a lot of them actually have bombs and ICBMs. I eagerly look forward to our invasion of each and every one of those nuclear states.
I was hoping to have a discussion with you instead of just triggering rants.
Well, wait, Michael. I also want to make a point that's really very important and that needs to be, it's a radical, that is, at the root discussion. The notion that only certain countries can possess nuclear weapons is both unreasonable in the sense that it doesn't seem to be enforceable and unreasonable in the sense that it doesn't have any moral justification. You can't say it's okay for Israel to have weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons, that it's okay for North Korea to have weapons of mass destruction, that it's okay for Pakistan and India,
and
I can go on
Britain,
and on and on.
France.
But not okay for some other country, too, because we don't agree with that country?
We're going to have to leave it there.
It really doesn't make sense. Always run out of time, Michael. I'm always wanting to argue with you.
But it is, that was an instructive phone call, that even after 10 years have gone by, even after clearly the justification for the war were demonstrably false, we still have people believing it was a rational decision.
I'll see you downtown, Morrison and Broadway, 3:30 today.
Thanks for your calls, everyone. We'll be back at you next week.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
KBOO Community Radio turns 45 this year, and our first 2013 membership drive starts on the 21st. Help make reaching our $99,000 fundraising goal a little easier by offering a matching donation of at least $500 for us to use on air during the drive. Matches are really great motivators to entice our non-contributing listeners to donate, so please email membership@kboo.org if you would like to offer a match or have any questions. Or call 503-231-8032 and ask for the membership department to plan your spring drive matching gift today.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock, almost a minute after. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. At 9, alternative radio. Well, I guess it won't be at 9. It's going to be like at 9:02. Alternative radio independent journalist Christopher de Blague speaks on Iran, coups, sanctions, and threat of war. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints marks the 10th anniversary of the war with Iraq with a new radio documentary by Nora Barrows Friedman. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host Dee Mae Roberts looks at Milagro Theater's Guapa, an inspiring tale of a young woman's dream to be an international soccer star. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Galavan interviews Portland artist James Minden about his current exhibition of handmade holograms titled Real Unreal. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, please go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Now here's Alternative Radio.
Anyone who is toying with the idea of an attack on Iran knows better than I the response that would follow and the chaos that would ensue. They also know that an attack on a nuclear complex is unlikely to obliterate and end nuclear ambitions. They may even excite the Iranians to greater efforts. And so what you're looking at is a kind of unending wave of attacks, which the Iranians would naturally reply to. So the prognosis after any attack is extremely bleak.
That's Christopher de Blague, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Christopher de Blague on Iran, coups, sanctions, and the threat of war. Operation Ajax was the code name for the CIA coup, which destroyed democracy in Iran. In 1953, 60 years ago, the U.S. overthrew a populist government and put the Shah in power. Actions have consequences. The Shah was overthrown in 1979. Today, the U.S. and its allies have imposed severe sanctions on Iran. A major war is possible. All options are on the table, is ritually intoned. Iran is enriching uranium, as is its right, as a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Washington accuses Tehran of seeking technology to build nuclear weapons. Iran denies those charges and has called for a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. The U.S. regularly violates Iranian airspace with surveillance flights, and its warships conduct what are called routine exercises off of Iran's coast. Imagine if the reverse were true. Think there might be a response from Washington? To talk about Iran is Christopher de Blague. He's an independent journalist. His articles appear in The Economist, The Financial Times, The Independent, and The New York Review of Books. And he reports for the BBC. He's the author of Rebel Land, The Struggle for Iran, In the Rose Garden of the Martyrs, and Patriot of Persia. He spoke at the University of Denver.